prepare for a true revolution.
Actually, you can prove God exists.
Questioning tradition, because what you've been taught isn't always true.
The truth will set you free.
That is so true. The truth will set you free. We are Truth Revolution. I'm Dave. With me is Pastor Jeff from Revolution Church.
And
this is where
faith
and reason meet.
Woo! This is where it comes together right here. Logic. You like logic. You like science. That's cool. Yeah. Because we like it too. And we also like God.
Yeah, I've taken your logic class, man.
Mine?
I'm not so sure I like it.
And you didn't even take it when it was a college course.
Right. It's crazy.
It's intense.
It is.
But look, we like information and facts and truth. Mm-hmm. And we like it in religion and we like it in science. We want to know the truth. And we can pursue the truth no matter what we're doing, whether we got our Bible or our science books open.
Amen. And I think it should be everybody. If you live on this planet, your job should be to seek out truth. Because what have we if we have not truth?
Good. And today we got some serious, serious stuff we're talking about. We have a special guest with us today, Alan. And Alan, you're going to have to pronounce your last name for me. Help me out here.
That's okay. It's Schliemann.
Schliemann. There we go. I was going to say Schlemone, and then I thought, man, I didn't even ask him before we called how to pronounce his name. So we have a special guest with us today, Alan Schliemann from Stand to Reason. Their website is str.org. And Alan here is a graduate from a very, very, very good university.
So, why you say that, man?
Well, go ahead and tell people where he's from, right, Dave.
Alan graduated from California State University. Long Beach.
That's not the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know. But holds a master. Well, I wanted to keep you intense there. But he holds a Master of Arts in Christian Apologetics from Biola University.
Oh!
That sounds very familiar. But he's been a guest on both TV and radio and has spoken to thousands of adults and students across the country at churches, conferences, and college campuses. And he lives in sunny San Diego, California with his wife, Jennifer, and two children. Sounds like you have the perfect life, Alan.
Oh, yeah. What's the temperature there right now in California?
I don't know. I don't really. Nobody really checks the weather here. Cause
why would you?
Around 70 something.
Oh, that's awful. That's not cool at all.
The pitchforks have come out.
No.
I know. Pray for me. I need help.
Good. Well, today we are talking about a very sensitive subject, which is abortion and euthanasia. And what we don't want to do, we don't want to come into this and just say, hey, we're going to come with hatred and anger.
Oh, no.
And we're not going to do that because we believe in Jude 2, which says, mercy, peace, and love be yours in abundance.
Amen.
And so we want mercy and love and peace to prevail here today. But we brought Alan on because this is his specialty. He's really, really good at this. And so, Alan, I'm just kind of curious, how did you get started studying about abortion?
I think it was probably, I'd say at least now 12 years ago. And I had been attitudinally pro-life. In other words, I thought to myself, I'm a pro-life person, but I didn't really ever do anything about it. I just kind of thought, well, I'm against abortion. I'm for life. And then what it was is my boss-to-be, Greg Kokel, who's the founder of Stand to Reason, he had produced a small little book called Precious Unborn Human Persons. And in that book, he kind of opened the door to understanding really what abortion was all about. And I saw some images of what abortion did to unborn children. And I think as a result of those two things, sort of the intellectual element and then the visual element of seeing what abortion actually is, it kind of pushed me over the edge and made me think, man, this is a major social justice issue. I need to do something about it. I mean, this is the social justice issue of our time. And as a result, that kind of propelled me into considering to take this issue more seriously.
That's interesting. So when you come into this, let's just get the hard question out of the way so we can go on to some more detailed, nuanced, logical information. When you sit down, if you sit down with a woman who has had an abortion, do you point at her and tell her, you know, do you yell sinner at her? Or, I mean, what's the correct response there? I mean...
No, I don't yell at her. Usually, okay, so...
That's the right answer, by the way.
Let me give you some framework for where I'm coming from. One of the main principles behind what we do and what I do at Stand to Reason is we're trying to help people become effective, what we call ambassadors for Jesus Christ. So clearly we follow Jesus Christ, but that doesn't mean we go around shouting at people, calling them names, trying to belittle them or anything like that, because we're an ambassador. And an ambassador is a particular type of person who, based on the manner in which they communicate, based on the impression they leave with somebody else, that thing will eventually will say something about the person or the thing that we represent. And since we represent Christ, we want to engage in a thoughtful and persuasive, yet gracious and winsome manner when we're talking to people who we disagree with.
Amen.
So I was mentioning to you off the air that I speak on homosexuality, I speak on Islam, I speak on abortion, euthanasia, and so these are controversial issues.
Yeah, why didn't you pick a difficult topic? I mean, you picked all the easy ones.
Yeah, I know, where everybody agrees with me, right?
Right.
Yeah, so when I'm speaking on these issues, I'm very mindful of the fact that people vigorously disagree about these things, and perhaps even have good reasons why they disagree with me. And so I want to approach them in a way that says, hey, look, I respect you, I understand we disagree, but let's talk about this in a civilized way. Let's look at the facts, and as you were saying in your intro, let's look at what science says, let's look what the facts say, and let's talk about this, because I want to be gracious to you, because after all, if I come across as a jerk, then you're going to think the person I represent, Jesus Christ, is also a jerk.
Yeah.
And so that's why we want to be very mindful about the way we approach people. And so when I sit down with a woman or sit down with who's had an abortion or with any person who's an abortion choice advocate, I try to, in a very calm and collective way, engage them about these issues if they're wanting to talk about this and try to present the best persuasive but gracious case that I can offer them.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. So listeners, I also want to make sure you absolutely heard here what he said, and that's that today you're not going to hear pointing fingers. Mm-hmm. You're not going to hear someone shouting the word sinner at you. Hopefully you're going to hear a gracious case of why we believe what we believe about abortion. And, you know, Alan just said it. He's willing to listen to what other people have to say.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate thing, though, that we have to actually say that, because we have people that have come before us that have done the exact opposite, you know, pointing fingers and basically lambasting people, telling them that they're going to hell for whatever they do. And that's like totally like anti-ambassadorial.
Ambassadorial.
Is that even correct?
It is a word now.
It is a word now.
StandToReason.com/ambassadorialites. No, just kidding.
Give yourselves credit for that one. That's a good one.
Good. So, you know, and speaking of conversing with people, there's a lot of crazy talk out there about abortion. George Carlin, who's a famous guy, he's done a presentation on abortion. I got some quotes from him. Can I play those and let you respond to him a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, here's the first one.
Pro-life conservatives are obsessed with a fetus from conception to 9 months. After that, they don't want to know about you. They don't want to hear from you. No, nothing. No neonatal care, no daycare, no Head Start, no school lunch, no food stamps, no welfare, no nothing.
Okay, so did you hear that? It was kind of quiet.
Yeah, I think I got that.
Okay. Now, what's he's saying? You're against abortion, but then when the baby's born, you know, forget him. We don't care to help the poor people. What's your response to that? I think his logic argument would be something like, if you're not going to care about the kid after it's born, it's just as good to eliminate them before they're born. I mean, what would your response be to that?
Okay, well, the last thing you said is a little bit of a different argument, which I can address later, but going to what he said, first of all, just looking at the facts of the matter, it is not the case at all that people who identify themselves as pro-life don't care about babies after they're born, or even the women who are the mothers of these children. In fact, if you look around the country, there are thousands of what we call pregnancy resource centers, or sometimes they're called crisis pregnancy centers, that actually provide care for women who decide to keep their children despite perhaps pressure to have an abortion. So when they make that tough choice and decide to keep their kid, whether they want to, you know, parent it themselves or want to give it up for adoption, there are organizations all over the country run by Christians, pro-lifers, who are either giving money towards those things, who are providing them with diapers and other kinds of resources and care, pointing them to places where they can get other kinds of help. There are homes that take people in that have that are facing these kinds of conditions. I mean, it's absurd to say that pro-lifers are people who don't care about the babies after they're born. In fact, we care about the babies and their mothers after they're born.
I think it's a really good point. We care about the babies, but we also care about the mothers.
Amen.
This isn't just one life we're talking about. We are talking about the women, the often young women who feel scared and lost, and they don't know what to do.
That's right. That's right. And that's why there's so many pregnancy resource centers. In fact, there's several thousand more than there are Planned Parenthood centers around the country. There's such an outpouring of people who care about this. And this all goes back to the fact that, you know, Christians have a belief system that all human beings, regardless of age, regardless of development, regardless of gender, are valuable, intrinsically valuable, meaning their value cannot be taken away. So whether they are a human being inside a woman's uterus, or whether they're outside the uterus, or whether they're a mother, or whether they're a child, they are still intrinsically valuable, equally valuable to everyone else.
Amen. Absolutely.
And that's the principle that drives our care for these individuals.
Yeah, and we might even add to that, regardless of what someone's done, we believe that they are intrinsically valuable as a human being. And so even if you come to believe that, you know, abortion is wrong and you've had an abortion, we don't say, well, you're less of a person now, or we look at you any differently. That's just not the case.
Right. Actually, quite the contrary. I think people who have done those kind of things deserve more care, you know, because they've really actually... There's something goes on with the psyche when you do something like that. You feel like maybe you're unredeemable or something, you know, and we should show them more love.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now,
and a lot of these women who do have abortions, at the anniversary of each year when they would have had their child, they oftentimes go through an incredible amount of depression and regret. And there are numbers of also post-abortive care organizations run by pro-life Christians, again, because they care about these women, even though they made a choice that we often try to do the best we can to stop them from making,
all right,
which is to have an abortion.
Good. Here's another quote by George Carlin, almost along the same lines, but slightly different angle.
Pro-life. You don't see many of these white anti-abortion women volunteering to have any black fetuses transplanted into their uteruses, do you? No, you don't see them adopting a whole lot of crack babies, do you? Now, that might be something Christ would do.
Now, obviously, a very inflammatory and offensive statement he just said there, but, you know, what would be your response to that, Alan?
Yeah, well, I mean, this certainly makes for perhaps good comedy for some people, but a lot of times comedy might, you know, people think, well, it's based on some, you know, element of truth. In this case, it's not. It's actually the opposite. In fact, if you look at the CDC statistics, They have certain numbers of how many children are available for adoption or foster care. Mm-hmm. And you look at the number of infertile couples who are trying to adopt, and many of these are pro-life Christians as well, there is a greater number of adults and couples that are trying to adopt than there are children who need to be adopted. In fact, one of my good friends, just this last year, he got married. Him and his wife are probably in their early 20s. They're a perfectly healthy couple. They kind of have their whole life ahead of them. And what they said to each other is, you know what? Because we see a need in children who are neglected, who are ill, who are minority status, we want to adopt a child with Down syndrome. And we only want a child with Down syndrome. And so they went pursuing, looking for an opportunity to adopt a child with Down syndrome and not, you know, not some, you know, quote-unquote healthy white kid.
Yeah.
And so finally, after a number of months pursuing it, they finally found a family who, when they had their child, it turned out they had Down syndrome, they were willing to give it up for adoption, and they went ahead and adopted the child with Down syndrome.
Yeah, perfect example.
I see this all the time. You know, this isn't just an isolated incident.
Right.
You know, this happens all the time, that people care about not just perfect, healthy white babies,
and you know,
but even children who are facing incredible need.
Absolutely, and I would jump in there and say myself. We do foster care, and we've adopted multiple children. We've taken guardianship for multiple children. We brought over 40 kids into our home through foster care. And there's definitely a need for foster homes, or short on foster homes, but there is a plethora of people wanting to adopt babies. So
Amen.
This idea that we don't want to adopt these crack babies is just a lie. All right, we're coming up against the hard break here, so we're going to come back after the break, but this is good stuff. We're on the other side of this break. We're not going to look so much at the emotional side and some of the crazy things that George Carlin said. We want to look at some of the logical arguments. Abortion, right or wrong, is it a person or not? All right, get on over to truthrevolution.tv, check it out, and str.org.
Hey, this is Pastor Jeff from Revolution Church.
And I'm Dave. We've been growing and now we're going to two services.
Sunday morning at 9 a.m. or 11:15 a.m. Check us out at salinarevolution.com.
What if someone had never been to church before?
Well, most people here hadn't been for a long, long time, if ever, so don't worry, you'll fit in fine.
What to wear? Just be yourself. Jeans, t-shirt, tats, whatever.
Revolution Church, Sunday morning, 9 or 11:15 a.m.
salinarevolution.com or check us out on Facebook.
Revolution!
Hi, this is Pastor Jeff from Revolution Church. Not only am I the host of the Truth Revolution radio program, but I'm also a foster parent. Did you know that there are only 20 or 30 children in Salina that need to be adopted right now? Did you know that there are children in foster care who want to live in Salina, but are sometimes placed in other towns because we don't have enough foster homes here? I want to challenge you to consider foster care today. If you're interested in doing foster care, go to kfapa.com, that's K-F-A-P-A, as in the Kansas Foster and Adoptive Parent Association.com, K-F-A-P-A.com, and get more information. You can request information, email and ask any questions you want, or possibly even sign up to take a class about foster parenting. It's easier and more difficult than you'd ever imagine, but it's also more rewarding than you'd ever imagine. Consider fostering and helping a child in need today.
Truth Shots from TruthRevolution.tv and Revolution Church. Here's your host, Dave, and Pastor Jeff.
Do science and religion conflict?
One author has seen four possibilities. They either conflict and are incompatible, or they're independent and just work in their own areas.
Or they dialogue, that is, they share information, or they integrate, meaning it's possible for them to work with each other regularly.
We prefer the dialogue or integration viewpoints. We believe that science is an attempt to find the truth.
And so is Christianity.
Both science and Christianity can contribute to the development of inclusive of metaphysics.
For instance, the teleological argument infers the existence of a creator from our understanding of the natural world.
On the flip side, understanding the mind of God gives us insight into the world and belief that there is order and logic behind how things work.
Similar to how early scientists like Newton, Kepler, and Copernicus viewed things.
For Christians, it should just make sense that studying the world around us should fit with studying the one who created it.
Amen.
TruthRevolution.tv.
Did you know that Truth Revolution is supported by Revolution Church and listeners like you?
It takes quite a bit of time and money to produce a quality radio show.
If you find Truth Revolution helpful, a donation would be a powerful way to make sure the message keeps going out.
This ministry is doing more than Dave and I imagined it would at the beginning.
You got that right.
And as we grow, we want to keep the goal the same. To be the place where faith and reason meet.
Donations are accepted at www.truthrevolution.tv or Revolution Church.
Truth Revolution.
And we're back.
All right, truthrevolution.tv. You got to get out there and also on out to Revolution Church. Sunday mornings at 9 and 11:15. Although,
right, we are getting ready to switch.
In a few weeks, we're going to switch to 9 and 11. Apparently, the 15 was throwing people off.
It was throwing me off.
It was throwing Dave. He was showing up late to first service and early to second service. Not really. But 9 and 11 is where we're going to be in a few weeks. But you can just come out to Revolution Church right now. Doesn't matter what you're wearing. Jeans, t-shirt, pajamas. As long as you got something on.
Yeah.
Get on down here.
You know, early on Sunday morning, I just washed my brain. Can't do a thing with it.
You just washed your brain.
And yeah. And it's just.
I have a scientific problem with that. No. All right. We're back with Alan. We're talking about abortion today. We looked at some of the emotional things, some of the colloquial weird questions that people ask, such as George Carlin, but we want to get into a little bit of the science about abortion. Now, tell me, Alan, when Roe v. Wade happened, when people were looking at abortion way back then, I mean, didn't they examine this? Wouldn't people say that they examined abortion and concluded that this wasn't actually a human being yet, and so it was okay? Well, didn't the court figure that out?
Yeah, you would have thought they would have, because even at that time, we kind of knew about the science. But yeah, they decided to say, or I should say, they concluded that because there isn't sort of this agreement as to when life begins, the court should not propose one theory of life over another. So in other words, they said, well, you know, there isn't any kind of consensus on this, so we're not going to force a decision. But by saying we should allow, therefore, abortion to occur, they were saying that life begins after birth, you know, because otherwise, why would they go ahead and say it's permissible to kill the unborn?
Absolutely. I mean, you could almost make the same You could almost make the same point with slavery. I mean, if you could say, well, you know, we're not quite sure whether these slaves were actual people or not, therefore we're going to continue to allow slavery. I mean, that's a ridiculous argument.
Right. I know. That's what they said. They said, we're going to leave it up to individuals to make their own choice because we can't, you know, decide and propose one theory over another.
Well, you would have thought that they would have actually given some kind of thought to, let's err on the side of safety here and wait till we actually have more information.
You would think. But we're talking politics.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, if you're unsure that whether the unborn is a human being or not, then correct. Err on the side of caution and not go ahead and allow people to kill the unborn just in case. Killing innocent human beings.
Give us some insight in here. Why do you say that the science favors the unborn as a human being? Or what science is out there that shows your side of the argument?
Yeah, I mean, the science of embryology, and embryology is simply the study of embryos and the fetus early on in development. The science of embryology is really decisive on this question. And I would argue it proves the unborn as a human being. And just so you know, I don't use the term proves very often because it's a rather strong term.
Mm.
Like I wouldn't say that I can prove God's existence. Yeah. I think I could give arguments to suggest that he exists. But I think when it comes to embryology, we can prove the unborn as a human being because embryology teaches three things. First is it teaches that the unborn is a living thing, meaning it's alive. The second thing that embryology tells us is that the unborn is a distinct, unique individual who is different than the mother.
Okay.
And the third thing that embryology shows is that it's a human type of being, not a dog or some other kind of being. And you can take each of these three and look at what embryology specifically says. So, for example, the first one, which is the unborn alive? Is it a living being? Well, clearly, this is perhaps the least controversial of the three.
Right.
Embryology teaches us that, yes, the unborn is alive because it grows, it responds to stimuli, and it metabolizes nutrients and converts it into energy. And typically, biologists and scientists know that if something is doing those three things, growing, responding to stimuli, and metabolizing nutrition, then it must be alive.
I've been metabolizing things into nutrition all day long.
Oh, yeah. You look
pizza.
Like that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there you have the first thing, the first component. The second component is this living thing then part of the mother's body? Is it simply the mother, like her appendix or her tonsils?
Right, because this argument is the argument is made all the time. Well, hey, it's my body,
right?
And yeah. So we, you know,
therefore
that,
it's my choice,
right? So we have to ask the question. You know, is this is certainly going on in your body, but is this
correct?
Is this embryo? Is this something different than your body?
Right, and also when you if you break it down to the DNA and look at it, it's like you have a mix of the father and the mother in there, so obviously it is not just my body.
Right.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the arguments we offer is that its genetic fingerprints, if you will, are unique and separate than the mother. And typically in like say a homicide detective case, you know, if we find DNA, that is usually matched to a certain person and we can distinguish different people based on their DNA. So that's one piece of evidence that tells us the unborn is not the same as the mother. Furthermore, the unborn has its own heart, its own circulatory system, its own perhaps blood type, its own brain, its own brain wave pattern. The unborn could be a different gender than the mother. It could be a boy. So we have all these pieces of evidence that tell us that the unborn is a unique individual and not merely part of the mother's body.
Okay, now that's a good argument, but I have a clip from YouTube where there's some students who are making a case for abortion, and I'd like to play that for you and get your response, because they would argue that what you just said doesn't matter so much. Here we go.
Okay.
You may not know this, but there's a difference between a baby and a fetus. Babies are cute, happy, and alive. A fetus is an organism that grows in a woman's womb until it becomes a baby, but that takes a while. Nobody knows for sure the exact point when a fetus becomes a baby, but it's somewhere around when the first brain activity is detected. Scientists have determined that the first brain activity in a fetus usually shows up around the 6th week of pregnancy, and 68% of abortions take place before the first 7 or 8 weeks.
Okay, so the first brain activity is when this becomes more like a human being, and that's about the 6th week of activity. So it may be separate, it may have different DNA than its mother, but these guys are saying there's absolutely no brain activity, therefore it's not a being on its own.
Okay, yeah, there's two ways to address this concern. And the first question, when somebody brings this up to me, I ask them, okay, so according to your view, the unborn becomes a human, or however you want to call it, at 6 weeks. So then my question to them would be, would you then agree with me that we should outlaw all abortions after 6 weeks? and say, let's just say, okay, yeah, we'll make abortion legal up to the first 6 weeks, but then after that we would make them all illegal. Now, I will guarantee you, you will not find an abortion choice advocate who will say, okay, yeah, you're right, let's go ahead and outlaw all abortions after 6 weeks. Because mm-hmm. this is simply a smokescreen to simply just make the case that abortion should be legal for all 9 months of pregnancy for virtually any reason.
Good point.
So even though they raise this issue, or for example, even the issue of rape, they'll say, oh, well, you know, some women are raped, they get pregnant, they should have the right to an abortion. And now we can talk about rape in a minute in a little bit more detail, but the first question I ask is then, well, okay, so would you agree with me then that if we made abortion legal in the case of rape, we should then make abortion illegal in all the other 99% of the cases?
Mm-hmm.
And they will always say, no, I don't want to do that. I want abortion legal for everything.
Right.
And it's because they're often raising these issues as simply a smokescreen or a tangent to try to mask the fact that really they want abortion for all people, for all times, and throughout all 9 months of pregnancy.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But let's look at the science.
Morally
and with the science, I mean, is this a human being if there is no brain activity, really? I mean, logically?
It is a human being, and that's the second question, the third point I was going to make. So we said that the unborn is alive, the unborn is a unique individual, and then the third question is then, well, what kind of being is it? Because every living thing, based on our, you know, if you go back to, I guess, science high school, we learned about taxonomy, and taxonomy says that every living thing, plant or animal, has an identity, has like a biological address. And so we can ask then the question, since the unborn is a living thing also, what biological address does it have? Is it a chicken? Is it a dog? Is it an earwig?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a plant of some sort, like a petunia or a tulip? And we can determine the answer two ways. The first way is simply looking at its DNA signature. If you were to do an evaluation from even the first stage of development, which is called the zygote stage, this is where the unborn is at its first stage, you will be able to tell that immediately at that point you have a full human organism. Its DNA is unmistakably human.
Okay, now, that's good. That's good. I have a quote from the Pro-Choice Action Network of Canada where they bring that up and then they argue against it. We're going to try to hit that, you know, probably on the online only section, because
okay,
we're coming up. We only got 2 minutes left. We've got to do Bible contradiction because we do it every week. So hang with us, guys. We're going to do Bible contradiction. Come right back to this.
Bible contradiction.
All right, Bible Contradiction today brought to you by the fine folks at answering-christianity.com.
Okay.
Not to be confused as answeringchristianity.com. Totally different sites.
All right.
All right. Matthew 16:17. Well, first of all, how did Simon Peter find out Jesus was the Christ? Matthew 16:17 says, Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven."
So revealed by God.
Yeah. John 1:41. The first thing Andrew did was go find his brother Simon and tell him we have found the Messiah. His brother Andrew told him.
Are you kidding me?
This is their Bible contradiction, not mine.
I want to be respectful, but this is literally the worst Bible contradiction I've ever heard. We're not using that site anymore. It's too easy. Okay, we go to our cracked... I just can't even answer this. Okay, we go to our cracked acronym, and every letter works. Let's just first look at the letter C for context, or the second C for credibility. God all the time uses human agents.
Right.
All the time uses human agents. We say the Bible's written by God, but it was also written by prophets. God used the prophets. God used Andrew to go talk to... plus, his brother was just bringing him to Jesus. God was the one who revealed who Jesus was.
Right.
And so, you know...
God revealed who he was through his brother,
yeah,
Andrew.
This isn't a Bible contradiction at all. It's not even close to one.
Snuff that one out.
You know, we're going to go. We have a backup one in case of emergencies. Okay. We're going to try to do that online only.
So we can redeem ourselves.
Because this was just ridiculously not even cool, not even hard. Okay, so we're going to do a Bible contradiction online only. Also, we're going to stick with Alan. Got some deeper, harder. I'm going to push him to the breaking point until he cries like a baby.
You hear that, Alan?
All right. TruthRevolution.tv and STR.org. Get over there and check out Alan Shlomone.
Truth Revolution.
And we're online now.
All right. Thanks for getting over to TruthRevolution.tv. Dave, thanks for being here online.
Well, you know, I am putting a little bit of overtime today, so...
Yeah.
I expect to be paid double.
Okay, I will double your salary for this radio show. I'm going to double mine, too.
Right. We don't get paid for this stuff.
Alan, we're going to double your fee for being here today.
We're just being... I'll be rich, then.
Right.
So, all right. So, we're coming back here. We're going to hit a Bible contradiction a little bit, but we kind of closed here the show. Alan, you were saying that something is... You know, they're either a dog or a cat, or the DNA reveals what they are. And the DNA of these fetuses reveals essentially that they are human beings. Is that basically what you were saying?
Correct, yeah. Not partially human, not potentially human. They actually are human. And by the way, any medical textbook will attest to this statement, by the way.
Okay. Now, here's about.com says, and there's a couple different exceptions here. I want to get to about.com's first. They say human life actually begins prior to conception because each sperm and egg cell is a living thing. It is more relevant to discuss when sentience or self-awareness begins. And so they're making the case that, well, you could say this is a human being, it has life, but the sperm has life. And the egg has life, and this is just another kind of life. And so really the question is, when are they sentient? Now, how would you respond to that?
Well, this is just really, really bad science. I mean, I don't know, other than to correct the science, but any basic biology textbooks will clarify this. Sperm and egg are, yes, they are human cells, they are alive, but they are not whole human organisms. Sperm and egg are parts of an organism, whereas the unborn, even from the first stage of development, is a complete organism. And the way we know this is that sperm and egg each have only 23 chromosomes, and whereas a human being has the zygote that has 46 chromosomes. Moreover, the genetic signature of a sperm and an egg is very similar to its host, whether it's part of the, you know, whether it's from the mother or the father. Whereas the zygote, or the new developing human being, it has its own unique genetic signature.
Ah.
And then the other thing to keep in mind is sperm and egg have met their full potential, meaning if left in a proper environment, they will always just remain as sperm and egg. They will never become anything else. Whereas a zygote, a newly developed human being, if given the proper environment, will grow and meet its full potential by becoming an embryo, a fetus, an infant, and an adult, you know. So clearly these are completely different things, and any science textbook will tell you that they are not the same. A sperm is not a human organism. It is part of a human, but is not a whole human.
I think you just totally...
That's an obvious distinction that they should have known.
You just totally blew that one out of the water. I'm going to assume you don't talk about this very much, right?
Yeah, this is my first time. I just kind of went on Wikipedia and learned about it.
Wikipedia. Oh, that's awesome. don't you said Wiki? Don't say the W word on this show.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's not. No. All right. Another point about.com made. They said fetuses begin to develop a minimal brainstem at 7 weeks, but are not capable of consciousness until the third trimester, and most likely remain. Can you get through this without Dave groaning? Will remain unconscious until birth. So they are making the argument that consciousness is what makes the difference here.
Yeah, well, the problem with that is this. I mean, there are all different characteristics and qualities that people will try to offer to suggest that this is what makes a person a person. You know, whether it's consciousness or self-awareness or the ability to be aware of moral, you know, qualities. There's a number of problems with them. The first being simply that these are arbitrary characteristics that people are just inventing. I mean, why is consciousness the determining factor? You know, clearly we have a human being from the moment of conception. Scientifically, this is proven. Every medical textbook says that you have an unborn human being. But now someone's saying, well, whoa, not all human beings deserve to be protected. Let's just make consciousness this arbitrary characteristic that we will say makes you a valuable human being. And frankly, this is no different than the kind of discrimination that's occurred in the past. Recall, even in our own country's history, there were a group of human beings, you know, referred to as African Americans, that were accepted as being human beings, but based on an arbitrary characteristic, they were disqualified from being valuable. And what was that characteristic? Their skin color. So people arbitrarily invented a characteristic that they believed disqualified some human beings from being valuable so that they can exploit them, so they could enslave them, so they could do whatever they want with them. And the same thing's happening here. You have a clear case where you have the unborn being a human being, but people are inventing these arbitrary characteristics in order to disqualify them from being valuable. And this is unjust discrimination. There's no other way to put it, but that's what they're doing.
Yeah, and okay? You know, when we go back even to the philosophy part, I think you're absolutely 100% right. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the philosophy of it, the what makes a being is not properties. You know, properties are things like eye color, hair color, mm-hmm. skin color, smell, whether or not you have arms and legs.
Right.
This doesn't make up what a being is. A lot of times people will say, well, if they're not conscious, then it's not fully human being. Or if it's in the womb still, it's not fully human being. But if you were to put someone who is full grown inside, if you were able to stretch the womb of someone and wrap it around somebody, that wouldn't disqualify them from being human beings suddenly.
Right.
I mean, if you were to remove some arms and legs from somebody, that wouldn't disqualify them from being a human being. It is not properties that makes up a human being. It is your essence. That is who you are, regardless of what your properties are. And so,
yeah. And even if you didn't believe in God, even if you didn't believe that you are made in the image of God, you still have a human nature occurring immediately at the point of conception. And so then adding on this arbitrary characteristic, which consciousness is, by the way, is a degreed property, meaning you can have less of it or more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you create this really, this arbitrary way of disqualifying some people. And by the way, consciousness doesn't begin at birth. I mean, people aren't sentient. The first month after you're born, you're still not self-aware.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's why Peter Singer, who's a bioethicist, will say that it's actually permissible to kill newborns for up to a month if they are disabled in any way, and if it brings more joy for the parents to kill them and then have another child who will bring them more happiness. Peter Singer, by the way, is not some obscure, you know, bioethicist. He chairs the Department of Philosophy at Princeton University.
Yeah, I read some of that stuff about him probably maybe a year ago or so, and I was just totally thrown back by his assumptions and his assertions. I was like, what are you saying?
Yeah.
And,
well, that's the problem when you take consciousness as a quality, because then all of a sudden, wait a minute, are newborns conscious? Are newborns self-aware? No, they're not. And so he says, okay, well, then in order to be consistent, we have to also say it's permissible to kill newborns as well.
Well, and not only that, so I don't think Dave is actually self-aware yet.
Sometimes.
And so
it usually takes me a good 2 or 3 hours in the morning to get self-aware.
But,
that's right.
You know,
until my first cup of coffee, I'm not self-aware.
That's right. You know, and we laugh about that, but that's actually a philosophical point. You know, I fall asleep every night.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at what point, like you said, this is a sliding scale here. Consciousness is not on or off.
Right.
Self-aware is not a one or a zero. This is a scale. And when I'm asleep at night, I am much less self-aware, much less conscious than even a two-year-old who is alive and playing. So...
Yeah, and this would be the case for people who are under anesthesia, people mm-hmm. who are in reversible comas.
Yeah,
those are all people who aren't conscious or self-aware.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he said the magic word: reversible comas. Now we're going to talk about euthanasia. I mean, when is it okay? We're only going to hit on this real briefly before we get to that and ask him some hard questions. We're going to do...
You want to redeem ourselves, do another Bible contradiction.
I want to redeem the atheists and do another Bible contradiction.
Bible contradiction.
Are you saying the atheists are typically smarter than the ones over there at answering-christianity.com?
Yes, I respect them. Yeah. They usually have better problems than that.
Let's go ahead and hit this one. Let's head over to one of your favorite places.
Okay.
That would be evilbible.com.
Oh, I love evilbible.com. Yeah,
they've got a long track record with us, so we'll just go ahead and stick with them for now.
Do you think they link to us as much as we link to them?
All right, check it out. Clean or unclean? Evilbible.com says there's a contradiction here. Romans 14:14 says there is nothing unclean of itself.
Okay.
Deuteronomy 14:7-8, though, says nevertheless, these shall ye not eat of them that chew the cud, or of them that divide the cloven hoof, as the camel and the hare,
okay,
and the coney.
The coney.
Yeah, the coney, and they chew the cud. But divide not the hoof, therefore they are unclean unto you.
I was like, they are unclean.
And the swine, because it divideth the hoof. Maybe you got the
no King bacon
James version here. I'm like, really tripping.
You don't know how to read this. Yeah. You need to be more self-aware.
So basically they're saying, yeah, there are unclean animals in Deuteronomy, but in Romans,
it says nothing's unclean. Right? So, okay, so Romans says there's nothing unclean. The Old Testament Deuteronomy says it is unclean. But actually, this is a really good one.
Is it?
If you don't know how to interpret the Bible correctly, this is going to be a contradiction. And as a matter of fact, for the early Christians, this was a major, major problem.
Yeah, there were several arguments actually meted out in the Bible over this.
You said baconed it out. And so they weren't allowed to eat bacon, and this was a big problem for them because they want to eat bacon. But really, no, the deal is in our cracked acronym, the K stands for knit together.
Right.
Until you understand the Bible as a whole and that some themes and ideas are woven in and out of Scripture, you're not going to understand why some things are said. Now, Romans 14, he says, nothing is unclean. And so we look at that and we say, well, why would he say that? And he's having a discussion about whether or not it's okay to eat certain types of food that some Christians or Jews wouldn't want to eat, such as the things in Deuteronomy.
Right.
And so we have to go back and say, well, why did Deuteronomy exist? Why were these laws here? And those laws existed for one purpose, to bring Israel to a conscious awareness of what is holy and what is unholy. Okay, remember, they weren't allowed to intermarry with other nations.
Right.
We're okay with that now. They weren't allowed to wear certain clothes. They always had to wear robes with tassels on them. They weren't allowed to eat certain foods. Everything they did, it was, this is the way we as Israel do it. And it pointed out they were very, very different than the rest of the nations.
Yeah, where there were intentional degrees of what you can and cannot do.
That's right. And we come to the New Testament and we see Jesus and the Apostle Paul teaching us, look, there is holy and there is unholy. There is light and there is darkness. And what in common does light have with darkness? And the answer is nothing. You cannot take something that's holy and mix it with something that's unholy. God wasn't concerned about whether or not they were eating pigs. God was concerned about getting it way down deep inside their brains. Don't mix holy things with unholy things. This was what theologians call a shadow. Okay, right. When I look at the ground and I see a shadow of an airplane flying,
you know there's an airplane somewhere around.
Right. I don't look at the shadow and go, oh my gosh, it's awesome. I look up for the reality.
Right.
When we see in the Old Testament, don't eat pigs, I don't look and go, oh, pigs are awful. I look up for the reality. And the reality is,
they're awesome.
There's some things you should never do, and there are some things you, pigs, Dave, yeah, man, pigs, man. There are things you should not do that are unholy. There are things you should do that are holy and good. And the Old Testament rules here, it was merely a shadow. I can't go into all the verses why we know that, but it was merely a shadow to come. So Paul, in Romans 14, he's pointing out, there's nothing unclean in itself. In other words, the pig wasn't the bad thing.
It was us, man.
God was trying to say, don't be unholy.
Right.
And so that's the answer for Bible contradiction today. Thank you, evilbible.com, for redeeming atheists, almost, mostly.
Bible contradiction.
All right. Okay. So anyway, all right, Alan, thanks for sitting with us through that.
Sure.
Yeah.
That was enjoyable.
I prefer to have ones that are a little more difficult than just...
Yeah, sorry about that. I just kind of went through and...
So, all right, quickly, euthanasia. I know we've kept you longer than we said. And so if someone's in a coma that's not reversible, I mean, what do we do? I think euthanasia is one of the next upcoming huge issues we're going to have to tackle and deal with in bioethics. What's your take on it?
Yeah, it probably won't be euthanasia right up front. It's going to probably be physician-assisted suicide, which actually is very similar to euthanasia. In fact, I would actually say that euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide are the same thing, and here's how I define them. I would say euthanasia is when you intentionally cause the death of a person with a lethal drug. However, it's administered, that drug is administered by medical personnel, like a doctor or a nurse. Physician-assisted suicide is really the same thing. The only difference is that it's administered by the patient himself.
So
both euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide are basically the same thing. The only difference is who is the one giving the lethal drug. Is it yourself giving it to yourself, meaning that's physician-assisted suicide, or is someone else doing it for you, in which case we'd call it euthanasia.
Okay.
So physician-assisted suicide is already legal in a few states, like Washington, Oregon, Vermont, and I think Montana also has some... they might permit it, I'm not sure. But the point being is that physician-assisted suicide is really the entryway in which, if euthanasia ever becomes a full-blown thing, it's going to come through these initial rights that we're granting to people to kill themselves with the aid of a physician.
Okay. And how do we know when it's okay for someone to die and when it's not okay?
Well, it's not easy to answer quickly, but
you got 10 seconds. Just kidding.
Oh yeah, let's cover euthanasia in a minute. I will say this: that there are a couple of important distinctions you have to make in order to kind of walk through a little, like if you will, like a flow chart,
okay,
to help you decide whether it's permissible.
Is it a similar flow chart to the one you have on abortion?
Well, it looks something like that, but of course the contents are very different.
Right. Because just on a side note, Alan put together a really cool flowchart for abortion, and it's similar to the one he's talking about here. Obviously, the points are going to be different. But
is that online?
It is online, and is on his WordPress, so we're going to link to it. I'm looking at the flowchart right here. It's great. So if you want to know about that, an abortion, and it's called Answer Every Defense for Abortion. So we're going to get there. But go ahead with the euthanasia flowchart.
Yeah, I mean, basically you have to first ask, you have to make some distinctions. The first one is whether you view human beings as having intrinsic or instrumental human value. Now, these are just fancy terms for actually principles that I think everybody understands. Intrinsic means that if you view human beings as having intrinsic value, that means they have value in themselves, meaning they are not valuable based on what they can do or who they can become, but rather just valuable because they just are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to first acknowledge, or if you're having a discussion with somebody, determine whether they're seeing human beings as having either intrinsic or an instrumental value.
Mm-hmm.
Now, instrumental value simply means that you don't have value in yourself. You're only valuable because you're a means to some other end. And so you have to make this distinction. Then you have to make another distinction, which is whether you're providing basic care or medical treatment. Now, in the case of basic care, this is simply the nutrition and proper environment that any person needs to live, like food, air, and water.
Right.
And I'd argue if you're trying to deny a person food, air, or water, then that's a problem because those basic care things should always be obligatory. Medical treatment is different. That's using technology or medicine to treat a disease. Now, medical treatments aren't always obligatory. You don't have to always give them. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And whether you do or not depends on whether the treatment is ordinary or extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the third distinction. So once you kind of have these three distinctions in place, you can kind of move through the flow chart to help you understand whether, you know, it's permissible to let someone die or you know, what to do in the situation.
That's good.
So, for example... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's really good. I mean, you're making some very important distinctions here that people need to be aware of. You know, when people talk about, well, this person's on a feeding tube and, you know, we should just end their life because it's a bad quality of life. I mean, a feeding tube is really nothing more than a delivery system. And pretty much everybody at some point in their life has to have a delivery system for food, whether it's a spoon or a bottle or a breast that the baby is using. I mean, we've all had delivery systems for food.
Yeah, that's a great example. So that would be in the distinction of basic care or medical treatment. Now, in the case of a feeding tube, that technically is a medical treatment, but one of the points I make is that a medical treatment that is ensuring that basic care is provided, meaning it's ensuring that food, air, or water is being provided, should be always obligatory. And so, for example, my mom was recently hospitalized. She got very ill. She almost died. And after they did the surgery to save her life, she was on a feeding tube because she couldn't eat for a while.
Mm.
Well, that was just a temporary delivery mechanism, as you said, to provide her with nutrition, which is basic care. And so, therefore, in that case, we would say it would be unethical to remove the feeding tube simply because it's some sort of a medical treatment, you know? Because, mm-hmm. after all it's doing is providing basic care, food and water, okay? So, right. in that case, it would not be permissible to, you know, remove that feeding tube. Now, there's some cases when a person, let's just say they have a heart attack, the ambulance comes to get them, it takes them back to the hospital, but in the process of getting back to the hospital, they have, you know, severe oxygen depletion from their brain.
Okay.
And so when they finally make it to the hospital and they're put on life care, life support systems, they're virtually brain dead, or they are brain dead.
Okay.
But yet their body is still being kept alive by machines. Now, in this case, what I would say is happening is the death process has begun, and however, human beings have interrupted it and halted it. And so in some cases like this, it would be permissible then to remove the life support systems that are keeping the body alive, the heart pumping and the oxygen, you know, going through the lungs, simply because we want to just keep a human body alive at all costs. And that's not the case.
Now,
then it would be permissible to remove that kind of life support.
That makes sense. Now, how do you make the distinction between, okay, well, this person was dying and they're losing brain activity. It looks like they're on the way to death. So go ahead and take them off the medical devices versus, hey, there's an embryo here who doesn't have a lot of brain activity yet, but we still call them a human being. I mean, what do you say about that?
Well, that's the difference between no more and not yet. So, for example, one of the kind of casual illustrations we use is bananas. You know, it's like you have green bananas and you have brown bananas. The brown bananas you could throw away, although my wife would say you can make banana bread.
Right.
That messed up my analogy. So.
Mm.
But with brown bananas, it's over. They're spoiled. They're bad. Green bananas, you might not be able to eat them, but you know they're still future in them, if you will, that they haven't reached their kind of their full potential, and so we wouldn't throw them away.
Gotcha. And they're still a banana.
That's right. They're still bananas. So the person who has brain death is in a position where it is irreversible. We can't reverse brain death. Once your central nervous system nerves die, they are unreplaceable, unlike the nerves that are in your arms, for example, because those can regrow. And so when you have brain death, the person is gone. They are dead. Whereas an embryo is not dead in any sense of the word. They just haven't fully developed yet. They are not yet, as opposed to no more.
That makes sense.
So, you know, again, it's just a distinction that has to be made. But when you try to just lump them together, you're just not being very nuanced in the way people are talking about human life.
Absolutely. Great. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. I really appreciate this. Now, if people go over to str.org, they can find your information. You've also written a couple books, and I want to let people know about that. You've written The Ambassador's Guide to Understanding Homosexuality. And what's the main, obviously the book's about understanding homosexuality, but what's the main thrust of that book?
Yeah, well, one of the things I try to do there is again, using basic science is to look at what are the causes of same-sex attraction. Because a lot of people have believe sort of cultural myths. You're born that way. Sexual orientation is immutable. It's unchangeable. And so what's interesting is that scientific literature, for over 100 years, we have known what causes same-sex attraction, and we've been doing things to help people overcome their unwanted same-sex attractions.
Mm.
And so I talk about what are the causes that we've known for over 100 years, and what are some of the ways that we've used to help people overcome unwanted same-sex attractions for those people who want to get rid of them.
Okay.
So that's the main the meat of the book, but in addition to that, I talk about practical ways that believers can interact with their friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian, because after all, you know, we all know people who are gay and lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we, what sort of biblical principles can bear on our relationships that allow us to maintain our Christian convictions while also maintaining our relationships with these friends and family members who identify as gay or lesbian.
So I
talk about those things, and I try to give practical examples of what that looks like, whether they're friends, family members, whether they're Christians, whether they're non-Christians, all that stuff.
Great. Kind of like you talked at the beginning about being an ambassador, which is why it's called the Ambassador's Guide. So, and
We're always trying to do this in a winsome and gracious way.
That's great. And the Ambassador's Guide to Islam is another book you've written, and I would assume that it tackles Islam in much the same way. Here's the information, the factual information, but also here's how to deal with someone who's a friend or family member who is engaged with Islam. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I try to help explain some of the basic beliefs and behaviors that Muslims have to adhere to and to follow. And then also I try to give a real powerful tactic that helps people engage Muslims with perhaps the most common and important objection, and that is that the Bible is corrupted. That's the number one most common objection, and it's also the most foundational objection because it goes right to the heart of what is at stake between Muslims and Christians, and that is the source of divine authority. Is it the Quran, which is what Muslims claim, or is it the Bible, which is what Christians claim? And until you resolve this foundational question, it doesn't matter what other things you'll say, because the Muslim will return to his Quran and say, no, this is the word of God, so what you're saying is incorrect. Mm. And the Christian will simply resort to the Bible and say, no, that's the word of God, what you're saying is incorrect. So that dilemma, that stalemate has to be resolved.
Has to. That makes
sense.
And
that's what one of the tactics I teach is how to resolve that tactic. And that way you can then move forward beyond that.
Great. And these books are available at Amazon.com?
They're both available at str.org. We have a web store. And I think one of them is at Amazon.com. I'm not sure if both of them are yet, because the homosexuality one is newer.
Okay, great. Well, anyway, the listeners can get over to str.org and get them right there off your site. So that'd be great. So get over to str.org. We're going to link directly there. We're also going to link to the flowchart that Alan has created for answering every defense for abortion. And so if you want to see a picture of Alan, if you want to read his bio, if you want to get to str.org, see the flowchart or anything else that's good, get over to truthrevolution.tv.
And we'll point you the right direction.
That's right. Was that an overstatement?
It was totally an overstatement, but that's what you do.
That's okay, because in the cracked acronym, D stands for dialect, and sometimes the Bible uses hyperbole, and so do I. Therefore, it's okay. All right. Thanks for listening today. Get on over to truthrevolution.tv. Alan, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Dave.
All right. God bless. And listeners, truthrevolution.tv, we'll check you out next time.